This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Yeah, all right. It is Jay from Sub 70, January 20th. This episode, the big bulk of it is going to be an interview with Bobby Clampett. I'll tell you a little bit more about him in a second. I will say right now, one of the coolest tournaments on the Euro Tour is taking place, and the leaderboard is absolutely stacked. You got Ross Fisher, Thomas Peters, Rory's back with his heart issues and all. Matthew Fitzpatrick shot 63 in the third round. He's two back. Tommy Fleetwood, Thomas Detry is three back. You got Beef, Paul Dunn, Euro dominant South African, Dylan Fratelli, Brandon Grace, Paul Casey, Dustin Johnson, Bernd Weisberger. I mean, the leaderboard is ridiculous. So I'm looking forward to watching the final round of that tonight. Hopefully I can stay up and catch the entire final round. I do have a flight down to Orlando tomorrow, going to get some golf in and try to do my best to avoid the PGA show. So Bobby Clampett, awesome interview. Want to thank Bobby for coming on and spending some time with us. If you aren't familiar with Bobby, he had an amazing amateur and professional career growing up out on the West Coast and then playing on the PGA Tour and the Champions Tour. He had some really cool stories about playing at Augusta, his sort of relationships with Jack Nicklaus, Johnny Miller, and some of those other, you know, amazing guys that were playing in the 70s and 80s, dominating in those eras. After his playing career, he became a TV analyst and has sort of transitioned that into the instruction side of golf. He runs a golf school that focuses on impact zone. It's called Impact Zone Golf. We had a really funny conversation. He analyzed some pro golfers' swings. So he's got some cool comments on guys that he's seen play and guys that he's actually worked with as well. And we also talked a bit about course design, what he thinks is, you know, makes a good course and that sort of stuff. So really awesome conversation. Bobby was really gracious with his time and we definitely appreciate that. Check out his golf school at impactzonegolf.com. Here is the interview.
First off, I'd like to welcome Bobby Clampett to our podcast, PGA Tour winner, golf analyst, noted instructor. Bobby, thank you very much for taking your time to be on the podcast today. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, Jason. Thanks for having me on.
My first question is, now that you're teaching full-time, and I know you played competitive golf for many years, does part of you still miss playing the Champions Tour on a full-time level? And I know there's got to be a lot of rewards in teaching, but for that competitive fire that you had, do you miss it, or are you pretty good with, at this point, teaching full-time and kind of letting that go?
Well, I'm definitely good with it because it's my greatest passion right now. I loved playing the Champions Tour. I got to play 87 events out there over a five-year span, and just I thoroughly enjoyed it, loved every minute of it. I miss my friends out there. There's no question about that. I miss the camaraderie. I miss the competition. But as I got thinking about after the 2014 season and what led to making a decision to leave competitive golf and focus on our teaching, what really dawned on me was that there was plenty of guys to replace me on the Champions Tour. There's some great players out there and working hard. But there really isn't anyone to replace me for in the teaching area and leading the impact-based instruction that we do. So that was really the determining factor for me and trying to make as I look into the last couple decades maybe or three decades of my life and what I want to do and what I want to accomplish and contribute, helping the game and helping teachers teach better and helping students understand that this game isn't a mystery or an enigma anymore is my greatest joy and what I want to do.
Follow-up to that, people don't, or I don't know if everyone realizes how good those guys on the Champions Tour still really are, how high of a level they play at. Did you, mm-hmm. were you surprised when you got out there still how good the competition is, or did you realize these guys are still at that level and it's still that competitive and still that hard to win?
Yeah, I knew they were good. And when I got out there, it did surprise me how good they are. There's just so many and really, really good players that, and it seems that when they reach, they get to the stage of their careers, they are so consistent, and they just seem to show up week after week after week, performing and doing well. And you know, you look at a guy like Bernhard Langer at the age of 60, winning 7 of his 21 events last year, a personal best, $3.5 million in prize money, and it's just remarkable to watch the consistency that Bernie has. It seems that every week he tees it up, he's right there threatening to win. And you don't see that on the regular tour. You don't see that kind of consistency out of many of the guys.
Well, growing up, my other question is going to be here is essentially where you grew up at and your love for golf. So obviously you have a passion for golf, and there's not a better spot to probably grow up in and then come, you know, Monterey, California and those that area out there. How did you get started in golf? Did your parents play? What courses did you play in that area growing up?
Well, I actually got involved in golf. I had been bugging my mom for several years that I wanted to learn to play golf and tennis. Those were the two sports that I had an interest in. And I think as a young child, 7, 8, 9 years old, I was a little bit frustrated with team sports and some of the kind of bullying and ball hogs and that kind of stuff that was going on with teammates. And really, I wanted to do something more on an individual level where I didn't have to deal with any of that stuff. And golf was and tennis were two sports that attracted me. And when my mom and I moved out to Quail Lodge in Carmel, California, when I was 10, she knew the president and owner, Ed Haber, who was kind enough to give me a job, parking carts, cleaning clubs, picking up the range, that kind of thing, and return for playing privileges. And that's how it all got started. And my stepdad bought me a set of clubs, and Lee Martin, the head pro, started working with me and on my game. And within 6 months, I started to play in my first tournament.
At what age did the talent really start to stand out that you were going to be a top-level amateur player, and kind of take it to that next level? How old were you when that sort of started and you saw it and people saw, you know, what this could turn into?
Yeah. Well, I started winning junior tournaments when I was 11 in our local area and in Northern California. So that was one little turning point. Probably the biggest turning point, Ben Doyle came in to Quail and became the director of instruction there when I was 13, and I began working with Ben as Lee took a pro job in Florida. And within 2 years, I made some really good progress. And I remember shooting a 68 4-under par in a junior tournament, which was the first time I'd ever broken 70. And a month later, I won my first national junior tournament, the Big I, at the age of 15. And that was an event where 24 of the top touring pros were there, and I beat 18 of them off the same tees in the same competition at the age of 15. And that gave me a lot of confidence that I was on the right track and that, you know, maybe I could do something in this game.
Did any of the touring professionals from the Northern California area kind of take you under their wing and kind of guide you as your amateur career got stronger and better?
Well, probably my closest friend in that area would have been when I was in college was Johnny Miller. And John and I spent a lot of time together. We'd go fishing, we'd play golf, we'd just talk. And then I played a lot of of tour events when I was in college. I played 3 U.S. Opens, 2 Masters. I played the Western Open, Colonial, Memorial. Went over to France, played the Lancôme. So I had an opportunity to compete at a very high level when I was in college, and Johnny was at pretty much all those tournaments. So we played all our practice rounds together, and he was one who was so gracious to me and taught me so much. But there was really several of the touring pros. Jack Nicklaus took a real personal interest in me when I was 18 and playing in my first Masters, as his son Jackie and I were the same age, and I got to meet Jack at a junior tournament. And so when I started to compete on that high level, Jack would also play practice rounds with me, and I just learned so much from both those guys. Billy Casper was another one at that time period who I played a lot of practice rounds with, Gary Player as well. So it was, I was really fortunate to have that kind of environment where I could throw questions at some of the game's best and learn from the game's best at a very early age.
Do you think that contributed as well, where you were kind of ready when you were the low amateur in the U.S. Open and in the Masters? And what was that experience like as an amateur to play in major championships and compete and do well in it? It had to be really help your confidence out as you're kind of taking that next step forward, I'm assuming.
Yeah, because I was winning a lot of college tournaments, a lot of amateur tournaments, and to take it to that level is different. And, you know, to my first Masters when I was 18, I finished 23rd, which back then was good enough to get invited back the next year. And it gave me a real sense of confidence that I felt that my game was really progressing, improving, and I could take it to the biggest stages and levels and compete. My very first pro tournament ever was the U.S. Open in 1978 at Cherry Hills, and I was really not very prepared, but I found myself as the sole leader through 24 holes, and it was a little bit of a duck out of water, so to speak, and a little bit shell-shocked with the whole atmosphere, but I learned from it, and to have Johnny and Billy and Jack and everybody helping me along through that time period was really, really helpful.
So then you turned pro in 1980, and my first question is, did you get in to a lot of turns just from exemptions from your amateur career, or did you have to go to Q school? And then when you're now ready to be a professional golfer, did you do anything in your golf game to improve or to have the consistency that, since you saw it out there a little bit, of what it would take to be, consistent and to have the ability to compete at a high level out there? Or was your game pretty solid leaving college?
Yeah, well, having competed in all those tournaments and nobody at that time was competing on that level in college. And, so it was a great opportunity for me to get onto the tour and get a lot of sponsors exemptions and avoid having to go to qualifying school, which I didn't have to go. I was able to, they had a special ruling back in 1980 that allowed me, I made enough money in 10 events to secure my card. And that just kind of got me going. And then my first full year on tour in 81, I finished 14th on the money list. So that pretty well put me in a solid spot for a long time. But so it was nice to get off to that kind of start and to play that kind of golf, an extended several years to get a good start in the game.
And then in 1982, you win the Southern Open. You beat Hale Irwin, who was a great player. When you actually get that first win, is it life-changing? Does your confidence go to another level? Can you describe what it's like to actually kind of achieve that sort of level at the highest, competition that you're playing against? It must be incredible.
It was a big sigh of relief, clearly, to do that, especially the way I did it. Johnny actually called and left a message with the head pro as I made the turn there on that Sunday, and And it was very inspiring, and I went and birdied the first four holes on the back nine when I was tied for the lead with two other players. And that kind of opened it up and then went on to win by two. But, yeah, it was your first win is huge. It really is. The monkey's off your back. You know you're a winner. You know you belong. And you look forward to trying to take your game even higher.
And I, looking at the history, you play the tour until 1995. And then my question is, I saw an article you just wrote for Golf WRX, which I thought was really interesting on what Tiger kind of went through. You're looking for perfection. Looking back at your career, say from 1983 to 95, was there anything that looking back prevented you from winning more often? Was it a search for a perfect golf swing? It's sort of the summary I got from reading that article that you wrote.
Yeah, I got talked into that if I would leave Ben Doyle, my longtime coach, and start working with the best coaches or the so-called best coaches in the game, that it could really catapult me to even a whole new level. And I wanted to see how good I could be. That was really the driving force behind everything I was doing in golf, was personal best. It wasn't comparing to anybody else. I just wanted to see how good I could get. And I actually started to work with four different coaches, all of them big names that you would recognize. And they all had four very different things to say to me, but the one common denominator was they all wanted to change my style of swing. And I got talked into doing it with one of them and worked for many years trying to change that. And the bottom line was I never cracked the top 80 ever again. So that was a, you know, looking back, was a fatalistic move on my part. I take full responsibility for it, but it was the birth of my developing a whole new way of teaching golf and looking at the game, because what I realized through that whole process was everybody in the world teaches a style of swing. They try to convert their students to conform to a favorite style of swing. And I realized that that's not the way the game should be taught. It should be taught from impact backwards. That's the common denominator of all the best players. And all the best players have a wide variety of swings. When you look at Palmer and Nicklaus and Player and Trevino, and they all have hugely different golf swings. And Hogan and Nelson and Sam Snead. And then today you look at all the best players and there's a little more conformity today than there used to be, but it's more of a result of the way the game is taught than anything else. But there's still a lot of room for uniqueness when you look at the Jim Furyks and Bubba Watsons and some of the more peculiar styles of swings out there.
From your teaching standpoint, and we'll get into that a little bit later in the podcast, because I definitely want to dig into it, as much knowledge as you have with it. And you were, back in those days, you were trying to work with those teachers versus just getting to or work with their program versus you getting to the position that you always naturally did, which obviously had to be a really good impact position to play at the level you played at. So it makes sense from that analysis how you could come up with the teaching system you have now.
Yeah, and because it really was an aha moment that I had when I was working at CBS full-time and they had just developed the BizHub Swing Vision camera and we had all this new technology at our disposal. And I started to study the best players of the game and would see all these different styles and positions. And one player would be laid off, the next player was across the line, one player was upright, the next one was flat, one player had a long backswing, the other short, different types of hip turns, different shoulder turns, different left arm positions, different left wrist positions, et cetera, et cetera. And everybody was teaching students, well, there's only one way to swing. But the common thing that all these great players did is what they created at Impact. So it led me to a study of what is that they're creating at Impact and how do you achieve it? And that was where decided to write my first book, The Impact Zone, and introduce the whole concept of impact-based teaching as a whole new way of approaching game improvement. And it's launched into where we are today with Impact Zone Golf and all our instructors.
When you started working at CBS and you're up in the tower and you're analyzing the best players, did it change your perspective of how people or the best players of that era played golf? Was it interesting, or did it give you just a different approach to it from actually studying it from afar a bit versus being on the golf course? If that question makes sense that way, does it just give you a different perspective of how this player plays and what they do well? Did you learn a lot from being in the broadcast booth?
Yeah, I definitely learned a lot. My years at CBS, I had several different roles. So sometimes I was a roving reporter, and I'm actually out on the fairways with the players and studying them. I'm on the range with them. I'm looking at tape from them. As a player, you don't do these kind of things. You're more interested in your game, and you're not looking at what other people are doing. But at CBS, as a golf announcer, I'm there with the world's best week after week, watching and studying what they do. That's what I'm paid to do. And when I started to really study what they do, that's when it dawned on me that Tiger swings a lot different than Phil, who swings a lot different than Sergio, who swings a lot different than Vijay. And going down that whole list, you just see what they created impact is all virtually the same, but their ways of getting there are totally different. And that's when I thought and devised this teaching system that teaches anybody, regardless of their style of swing, how to create that tour-like impact. And that's where game improvement is met, and it just gets rid of all the mystery and enigma of the game. People understand that golf is a game of impact, not a game of style. And you can learn to play great golf with virtually any style of swing.
And that takes me to the golfing machine, which is, you know, kind of, for everyone who doesn't know what that is, that book had a huge impact in the early 70s, late 70s, early 80s time frame on a different way of teaching. And how did that influence you? And then, what parts of that Golfing Machine book are you still using today in your teaching, and is there some parts of it that you're not using as often that was in the principle, but you're still taking parts of it?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jason. So Homer Kelly, the author of the Golfing Machine, was a Boeing physicist, not a great golfer, broke 80 only once in his life, and wrote a book as a Boeing physicist wrote a book where he really looked at golf from a machine-like concept of based on laws of physics. And he devised the golf swing into 24 component parts and about 15 variations of each component. And as Ben Doyle would so aptly say, about a trillion different combinations of swing styles. But he would talk about, in the very essence, if you look at 1L, and Homer was kind enough to make Ben and I the two doctorates of their highest level of Golfing Machine. Even though I wasn't teaching at that time, he still bestowed that title on me, which was very gracious of him. But if you look at what he was really saying, was that there are lots of different styles out there, but the most important thing is the laws of impact, what you're creating. And the Golfing Machine went on to, after Homer died, the new owners took it over and did different things with it. And there's many Golfing Machine instructors around the world, and some of the well-known instructors, like the Stack and Tilt guys, Mike and Andy, and then you've got Sean Foley, all of them were Golfing Machine instructors, and that was their background. But then the instructors would basically get in arguments over what style of swing was best, and then they divided it up into swingers and hitters and all these different things of compatible components. And as Ben would say, you get lost in the variations. And so many people consider what I've created with the Impact Zone a golfing machine for dummies. That is more of a a very, very simple way to look at golf and look at game improvement by starting at impact and working backwards from there. And it was, in my opinion, the real essence of what Homer truly meant in the golfing machine, though it didn't quite come out that way. And clearly there are things that are in the golfing machine, the flat lead wrist that Homer talked about, that Ben Hogan talked about in his five fundamentals, is dynamic number one of our five dynamic system. Clubhead lag was, Homer Kelly called it the secret of golf, and it is the secret of golf. And that's dynamic number four of our five dynamic system. So there's parts of things that are in the golfing machine. There's things that weren't in the golfing machine, like dynamic number two, the 4-inch in front swing bottom, as some of the integral components of impact-based teaching. So it's clearly rooted in golfing machine foundations and fundamentals, much like many of the other instructors do in their teaching today. But it's going down a path of, in my opinion, what Homer really meant by how the game is best played. And that is not through style of swing, but by the laws of impact.
So basically you took those principles and just sort of made it, for lack of a better, easier for the general public, easier for your students to understand. It's just sort of sounds like a 2.0 version of those basic concepts, and not making it as complex as that book essentially has it.
Yeah, I think what I did is took some of the good knowledge of that book and applied it to a new approach and a new way of looking at golf instruction as from starting with what is the proper impact, and if you don't hit a good shot, then what is it about the impact that was not good, and working backward from there. And it's really a way that, you know, I started to apply this when I joined the Champions Tour. I hadn't played golf in 15 years and decided to dust my clubs off as old as they were and head out. And lo and behold, I get out on the Champions Tour, and my second tournament, I shoot 65-64 in the first two rounds and set an all-time Champions Tour record for 36 holes. And so I was able to apply some of these things when I got out there, and it really freed me up where I wasn't worried about style of swing anymore. And it helped me play better, and thus I made more money in the 87 events on the Champions Tour than I made in 400 events on the regular tour.
So when we're talking about golf swings, and I think this is interesting, of the impact zone kind of being the moment of truth, is there still some other foundations that you still like in a golf swing more, being flatter, being more upright, or does it not really matter that much in the sense, as long as you get back to that position where the moment of truth is, or is there some other foundations that an ideal situation you'd like your students to have?
No, that gets right into the whole style-based approach that's the norm and, in my opinion, the cause of why there's so many frustrated golfers in this world. And everybody's looking for answers in styles. And the more you can get away from styles and work from impact backwards, that's what's most important. And so, you know, as I've spent my last 10 years or so refining how we teach impact-based teaching and building a team of some of the more prominent instructors in the world, many of which are master professionals with the PGA, and doing golf schools and doing instructor training and so forth that I was doing while I was competing on the Champions Tour. And to be able to put it all together in a teaching system that really works, that's simple, and that students, you know, so students that come to me and say, where have you been? This is, you know, the best thing I've ever seen. I've been to everybody, and, you know, they made me worse, or, you know, they wanted to change my swing and it didn't make me a better golfer. And I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars investing in these named professionals to change my style of swing, and it didn't help. I get this every day. And this is what drives me to continue on building this new way of teaching golf.
Do your schools normally work in individuals, or do they do them by in groups? Also, for the listeners out there, where are your locations, and where's the best spot to find information on your teachings and when it's available?
Sure. So always going to our website, impactzonegolf.com. That's the best place. The website has a plethora of information. We have two physical academies with full-time staff and employees, and both of them are located in Naples, Florida. We have our indoor performance center, which we now share, or starting Monday, we'll share with the 22nd of January with Club Champion as our club fitting partner. And that's at 1040 Collier Center Way in Naples. And there we have a putting lab. We have indoor technology for private lessons, our pro shop, all of our training aids, our DVD program. All of that is available in our pro shop there. And then we have our outdoor academy is at the Tiburon Golf Club at the Ritz-Carlton Golf Resort in Naples, which is the premier golf resort in all of Southwest Florida, with two Ritz-Carlton hotels, a beach resort and a golf resort, and 36-hole Greg Norman design courses that host two major professional events on the LPGA Tour and the PGA Tour. So we really have an incredible setup there that we encourage our students to come down. We have ongoing golf school programs that are open to the public. They're open enrollment. The dates are all posted on our website under the golf school tabs. There are schools that I lead personally that are called our signature schools. And then there are golf schools that our lead staff instructors lead. It's a lower price point. So we really have the opportunity to meet the needs of all of our clients and get them started. The golf school is the best way to get involved in our program and really get immersed in it quickly and see what kind of difference you can make. It's only a two-day immersion class, and it's been an extremely successful program for us.
I'm going to ask you to put on your swing analysis hat. So I'm going to give you some names of touring pros that we all know. And if you can give a few quick comments on their golf swings, I think it'd be an interesting perspective for you to take on it. So my first guy, Phil Mickelson.
One of the great minds in the game. I'm a big fan of Phil as a golfer and what he's able to do. Clearly demonstrates all R5 dynamics beautifully, has great quantity of lag, as well as great quality, and Phil is one of those guys too. He's just got a fantastic short game, and when I look at what he accomplishes, he plays almost exactly very similar to my strategy and philosophy, how I play. And might be the one guy who plays closest to the way I play of any guy on the tour.
Bryson DeChambeau.
So I'm on Bryson's advisory team. John, his dad, and I grew up together in junior golf, and Mike Shy, his longtime coach, and I have been longtime friends. And Mike used to work with Ben Doyle and is another golfing machine student. So Bryson... Bryson has a big background in physics. When he went to SMU, majored in physics, and is a advocate of the golfing machine. And Mike and his dad enjoy it when Bryson and I get together because they say I'm the only one who can challenge Bryson on these kinds of concepts. I think Bryson's one of the great minds of the game. He really does have a thorough understanding. Now, his style of swing is very unique, isn't it? And we've actually had him into our indoor facility and put him on swing catalysts and actually studied what he does. But his impact is the same. It's fantastic impact. And his clubs may be 13 degrees upright. He may stand so close to the ball and so erect. Yes, he plays with one length irons. And you look at the things that he does, he's got such tremendous quality of lag on his downswing, beautiful impact position, very consistent face control. And there's a lot of really good things to his golf game and his golf swing.
Yeah, I had the pleasure of watching him last year at the John Deere Classic up close for all 18 holes. And if anyone wants to watch somebody who really can play golf and hit a golf ball, it was impressive to actually see that up close for 18 holes of how good he really is. Mm-hmm. He's good.
Yeah, no, he is. But again, you know, it's a very unusual and very different style of swing that creates the same impact.
Dustin Johnson.
Probably the best athlete on the tour. And when you look at just raw talent, it'd be hard to come up with anybody better than Dustin. Really has now reached a point in his game where he has no weaknesses. Everything from brilliant wedge player, brilliant putter, amazing driver of the golf ball. But when you look at his impact, it's flawless. It is so good. The way he actually arches his left wrist and bows it down even more to get more club face control. It's a secret to why he drives it so straight and hits it so long. So the combination of that raw power and accuracy is something that, you know, it's no wonder he lapped the field in Hawaii. He's just that good.
A couple more here for you. Tiger 2018 golf swing, from what you've seen so far in late 17.
Well, I like it. I'm actually glad to see that Tiger is going to go work by himself for a while instead of seeking the help of golf coaches. I think sometimes it gets him a little distracted and away from playing golf. He starts thinking too much about golf swing. His golf swing's so good already, and he just needs to get out and play. I think I personally feel that Tiger's going to make a full comeback if his body allows him to, and I think it's going to be a great thing for the game to watch Tiger and these new stars go head to head. It's something that every golf fan wants to see, and it may happen right here at Augusta this year.
Well, speaking of the young guys, Jordan Spieth, what's your thoughts on his golf swing?
Yeah, well, he's worked with Cameron McCormick since he was 12 years old. He was already a brilliant player when he started working with Cam. Kind of a kid shot 63 when he was 12 years old. That's just, I broke par for the first time when I was 14. So a one-of-a-kind kid. Big fan of Jordan's, just the way he goes about things, the way he handles himself. And his golf game, the way he approaches his golf game, everything's very systematic, a little bit like Bryson in some ways that way. Very different type of golf swing, but very, very similar impact. And a great controller of the golf ball and a great student of the game. He's kind of almost a mixture between Bryson and Phil Mickelson and Tiger, where he's just got a great mind. His only downside is he doesn't hit it as long as some of the others. But everything else, he's brilliant.
And the last one I have to ask, who was our guest last time, Mark Calcavecchia.
Was
thoughts
he really?
On Kelk. Yeah, he was great when he was on here too. But I have to ask you about Kelk's golf swing. And yeah, he was our last guest. He was great.
So I played with Calc several times on the Champions Tour, and we also played on the PGA Tour together quite a bit. I've always enjoyed playing with Calc. He's an amazing talent, too. You just look at what he's able to create with his impact. It's more of a homemade swing. It's, you know, not somebody, some It's not a style that teachers are going, you know, look what Mark Calcavecchia does, but look what he creates at Impact, and look at the consistency of his career. He's really funny to play with, because I've played with him when he's playing great. I've played with him when he's playing really poorly. And he wears his heart out on his sleeve when he plays golf. He's just the way he is, and you can just tell whether he's having a good day or a bad day. But he's also one of those competitors that he is not afraid to go extremely low, and he'll kind of ride that momentum like a stallion and just take it. And that's why he's got the Masters record for number of birdies on the back nine. And, you know, he's just that kind of player where when he gets it going, look out.
Well, he had some good stories about when he's not playing well, of what he'll do to a putter if it's not it's not working well for the captain of the ship. He was great when he was on there. Well, let's look at some golf course design thoughts that you have. And the question I'm going to ask is going to be a little lengthy here, but what principles do you think makes for a great golf course? And obviously where you grew up, you saw some great golf courses in that area. What can make a bad golf course? And then what's your general thought of, say the last 20 years, maybe since the Sand Hills came out in Nebraska, of sort of bringing back more of this golden age architecture where there's a little bit more width off the tees. You hear the word width all the time now, and a little bit more playability versus, you know, trying to make the golf course like a version of a U.S. Open where it's, you know, super tight, super difficult, and, you know, seems to be trending away a little bit from the designs from the 70s and 80s. And just sort of what's your general thought about principles of it, and when you do architectural work, what sort of vision do you have when you're doing consulting work or design work?
Yeah, well, a lot to this. First of all, I love playing classic golf courses. I think one of the great elements that makes a golf course great is one where a 35 handicap can enjoy it and a touring pro can enjoy it. When you get the mix of the two, that is, to me, is really the mastery of design. And the courses, some of my favorites right here on the Monterey Peninsula, like Cypress Point, for example, that Alistair McKenzie designed. The way Dr. McKenzie put the green structures together and the bunkering and used some of those brilliant cypress trees and pine forest and sand dunes to meander through the course. Visually, it's just incredible. Always drawing your eye to where it needs to be drawn to. And those are, you know, Pebble Beach the same way. And those are courses that 30 handicaps can actually play and enjoy playing. The greens aren't perched up 8 feet above the level of the fairway. The fairways aren't built so that they're convex, where the high points are in the center of the fairway and the ball continually runs to the woods or out of bounds. And that, to me, they actually have fairly small greens, which brings in a whole new dynamic of architecture. I think a lot of the modern architects, I was playing Poppy Hills recently, and the greens are just too big. They're just huge. And I think that, you know, too many of those kind of architects just build too big a greens. The greens are too high in most cases. They do it for drainage and for looks, but they really take the golfer who wants to run the ball up, or even the tour player who likes to hit it low into the wind, and takes those kind of shots away, where the Scots invented the game, and all the greens in Scotland start right at the elevation of the fairway and roll right up into the green so you can run the ball up. So those are some of the principles that I personally like. I think when you have a beautiful setting, you need to be simple with your design and not get too complex. But I will say this, you know, one of the I've been reading quite a bit lately. National Golf Foundation's been doing a lot of studies about the decline of the game and why we've lost 25% of our golfing population over the last 15 years. And they talk about the game costs too much and takes too much time, which they've actually made some improvements in both those areas. So the game costs less than it ever has. And it actually, you can play nine holes now, and that applies to your handicap. So that really helps. And they got marshals out there keeping play moving and so forth. So all those kinds of things have made some good improvement. And the other thing the National Golf Foundation reported was that the game is too hard, and that over 4 million golfers are quitting the game every year. We got 3.5 or more starting. So we're doing a good job getting people into the game, but what we're not doing well is keeping people in the game. And they say the game is just too hard, and they blamed a lot of the styles of golf course architecture. And I do think there was a time period where it got a little bit out of hand, didn't it?
Yeah, where it's like my golf course has to be harder than your golf course to make it a good golf course. You know, I'm a low handicap player, and you would go to some of these places and where the men's tees were, it was just, you got kicked in the teeth all day. I mean, I'm just not a tour, I'm not tour player good, and it was really hard. And I can see if you were a 10 handicap, you'd have no shot at some of these.
Yeah, and you don't want to go there as a low handicapper and lose a dozen golf balls every time you miss a fairway, that kind of stuff. So there was an element of truth to that. But what the bigger question, and this was something I learned in my 5 years on the Champions Tour and playing all the pro-ams that we played in, I played about 220 pro-ams. So that's almost 1,000 golfers that I played with in a five-year span. And getting to talk to them when you're out there for 5.5 hours with them, you get some good conversations. And one of the things that really dawned on me is the frustration level of most golfers. And now that I'm in the teaching business, I've had countless students that have come to me on the verge of quitting the game because they're frustrated. They can't figure it out. Their game, they've been playing for years and it hasn't gotten any better. And then they start getting into their 60s and they lose distance and their handicap keeps going up and they lose interest. Who likes failing at things? And there's not a lot written or talked about that. And I think it's one of the real ingredients and driving forces for me and why I decided to take this on and do what I'm doing, that we need to be more effective teachers of the game, because the average golfer has no idea when they hit a bad shot, why they hit a bad shot, nor how to correct it.
Part of that, too, is don't you think this push to play the appropriate tee box has also been good, where, like you said, when you start losing some distance in your 60s, there's nothing embarrassing about playing a 6,000-yard golf course if you swing a driver at 80 miles an hour.
Yeah, you play the appropriate tee boxes, no question about that. But sometimes you play a tee box that's too short for you, and all of a sudden the landing area goes from 45 yards down to 20, and the golf course actually gets harder, and who wants to be hitting 5 irons off the tee all day long? So you have to play the appropriate length of tee. That's no question about that. And that's another great thing about good architects, is they build golf courses that can be fair from all the different sets of tees, and you know, make you be able to play from, you know, a lot of times I'll go play a golf course, I'll go do an outing, and I'll play a course from the 6,000 yard tees when I usually play more from 6,800 to 7,200 yard tees. And so when I go do that, all of a sudden I'm faced with situations that if I can't put a drive within a 20 yard fairway, my ball's not even going to be in play. And so I'm faced with hitting irons off the tee all day long, and that's no fun. And the average golfer doesn't like that too. But I think there has been a big push for people to play the appropriate tees, and I think that's a very good thing.
Well, I also saw last year, we're out in Chicagoland area, you made a comment on Twitter, essentially, that you were going to maybe head back to play Rich Harvest Farms. So I'm wondering if you got to do that last summer. And then also, do you have any favorite golf courses in the Chicagoland area that you've played in the past?
Huh. Well, I'm a big fan of golf in Chicago, and all my years involved with the Western Golf Association and having won two of their tournaments in the same year. So we did not end up having the event at Rich Harvest Farms. We were looking to do that, and it just didn't pan out. And we kind of did it as an experiment to see if that would work. We're still looking at potentially bringing a golf school up to Chicago this coming summer, as we have a lot of students in the Chicago area, and now with our partnership with Club Champions based out of Chicago. Some of my favorite courses in Chicago, competed at in the Western Open many years at Butler National. I loved Butler National. I just thought it was such a great golf course. Super hard from all the way back, but that was a course that we didn't play it all the way back in the championship. We played it maybe at 68, 6900 yards, which was still a great test. Let's see, others, of course, Medina's a great test of golf, Chicago Golf, Kemper Lakes played the, I broadcasted there several times. There's just a lot of great golf in Chicago, Cog Hill.
Have you had a chance to play Shore Acres yet?
I have not, no.
Absolutely. If you love Golden Age architecture, being Seth Rayner, that golf course is just absolutely fantastic. If you're ever in town, you can get on that one, which I'm sure you can. It is so worth it. It's right up there with Chicago Golf Club for the quality of architecture.
I have to remember that.
It's fantastic.
Love that.
Well, the last questions I have for you, I've kind of asked this to everyone who's been on the podcast, and it's interesting to get their take. So these are kind of quick ones as well. So my first one is, if you could take three current PGA Tour players or Champions Tour players, it doesn't matter which tour they're from, and you get to go have a day with them on the golf course, maybe play a fun little money game and have dinner afterwards, what three guys are you taking and why are you taking these guys?
Current players?
Current players on Champions, either tour. Current players on the PGA Tour, or it could be guys who played the tour even. Let's go with that. They could be former tour players as well.
That's a hard question. Haven't really thought about that. You know, one side would be go get my buddies together, you know, pull a group like Bernhard and Tom Lehman and David Frost or somebody like that, and have a little group together with them. Another side of me would say, you know, I'd really like to play with some of the guys that I didn't get a chance to play with, like Tiger, Jordan Spieth, you know, maybe Justin Thomas. Just play with some of the young guys. So that would probably, I think I'm going to say, I want two rounds. I want 36 holes. I'm not just going 18.
I'm good with that. So, yeah, take take some young guys and then take some of your buddies. I'm perfectly fine with that.
Yeah.
Last time you ever had to pay for a round of golf, not at a club that you're a member at, but Bobby Clampett goes up to the counter and you actually have to pay.
Good question. Wow. I think I had to pay at Disney one year back in the mid or late 80s when I came in a day earlier than the tour allowed for practice rounds. And I think that was the last time I paid for a round of golf. So it's been a while.
Best golf shot you ever hit under pressure?
The best golf shot?
Best golf shot you ever hit. Could be amateur days, could be on either tour.
No, that's an easy one. That's an easy one because it was the 1982 U.S. Open, 72nd hole, second shot, trailing by three, and 246 slightly into the wind. To the front of the green, pins on 10 off the right, 10 on and 4 off the right. And it's a hole that my caddy, Mike Chapman, and I had already decided it was a three-shot hole under every circumstance. And when we got there in that circumstance, we realized you got to make three. There's no other score that's going to work on this hole but an eagle. And so I hit my Taylor Spoon, the original one, that little 110 CC head, 10 degree, and I knocked it right up on the front edge of the green between the gap between the ocean and the bunker right there, and made eagle, made birdie. to finish third. But that shot in that situation, needing to hit it, was a shot I'll always remember.
Best golf shot hit by another player that you actually witnessed or saw. So they're under the gun, you're playing with a guy, and they pull off a shot that you couldn't believe. What's the best competitor's under pressure shot you've ever saw?
Two come to mind. Hal Sutton hit a shot one time on the 15th hole at Congressional, par 5. A driver off the fairway. It was a blind second shot. And he just absolutely ripped it with a driver off the fairway. And we couldn't see where it went. When we got up there, it was 2 feet from the hole. And the crowd hardly even clapped. It was like it was to be expected. And taps it in for an eagle, easy three. Greg Norman hit a shot one time. I was playing with him in Houston, 6th hole at the Woodlands TPC. He had 263 to the front of the green on that par 5 out of the short rough and 293 to the flag. And this is back in the 80s when the ball doesn't go that far. And he takes this 3-wood out with no wind, takes this 3-wood out, and the ball goes up the flagstick, down the flagstick, and this very narrow green that's hard to hit even with a sand wedge, and knocked it 8 feet from the hole and made it for a 3. And, you know, those are the kind of shots that you look at, and I just said to myself, that's why he at the time was number one in the world, because he had the ability to hit those shots that guys like me didn't have. So those are two that pop into my mind, but I've been blessed having played over 500 PGA Tour events to see some amazing shots over the years of the world's best, and pretty remarkable.
Out of all the guys you played with, who had the most raw natural talent, in your opinion?
I kind of look at raw natural talent and athletic ability as two potentially different categories. I look at raw natural talent as a combination of natural athletic ability and mental acuteness. It's really hard to say. You know, I played a lot of golf with Billy Glasson over the years, and I grew up with Billy. And Billy was one of those who was hindered with a lot of injuries, had some 30-something surgeries and everything from knees and shoulders and elbows and all over the place. But to me, he won 7 times on the tour and was an amazing natural talent, just truly amazing natural talent. Had such a flair for the game, and I'd been playing with him since we were 11 years old. I look at some of the guys today in terms of pure natural talent, and you got to look at Dustin Johnson. There's nobody that has the pure, raw, natural talent. Back when I was playing more full-time, John Daly was one who had just pure, raw, natural talent. My goodness. So hard to say, but a lot of guys for different reasons. But, you know, Tiger's a pure, raw, natural talent, too.
Well, on the flip side of that, and I'm going to ask this, and it's no dig against the player, but who is a player that comes to mind who may have not had all of the greatest athletic gifts in the world, but just absolutely got the most out of their game by hard work, and they simply could get the ball in the hole?
Oh, there's two guys that clearly come to mind. The first guy is Tom Kite. Tom Kite is one of the great humans on the planet, and a guy I got to know quite well on the Champions Tour, and is an amazing competitor without, and I think he'd be the first one to admit it, without a lot of natural athletic ability. And the other one would be Scott Simpson. Very similar kind of player, and neither one are very long hitters. Both have accomplished a ton in this game. Both have won U.S. Opens, and without what I would call a lot of raw natural talent. Just hard work, gritty, good minds, good practice and discipline and good students of the game.
Best three golf courses in the world, and what makes them in your top three, in your opinion?
Well, the first one is an easy one. It's Cypress Point. The second one is not an easy one. I'm going to go with Pebble and Pine Valley. What makes them great? And if I could throw in a fourth, I'd throw in Old Collier Club in Naples. And for all the same reasons, sheer natural beauty, great golf course architecture and design. Course can be enjoyable for the 30 handicapper as well as the tour player. You could play any tour event on it tomorrow. And when you walk off the golf course, you say, that was a great day.
Well, the I have not played your fourth on the list, but the first three are pretty darn good if you're looking at world-class golf. So I'm with you on the first three that you have. They're fantastic. Last question I have, we posted that we were going to have you on the podcast, and Sean McKeel, the 03 PGA champion, sent this one over to us. So The question is, how did you start your love of flying? What current plane are you using, and what do you most enjoy about being a pilot?
So Sean's actually flown with me before. We're good friends. And his dad, of course, was one of the very first FedEx pilots in history. And Sean and I share that love of aviation. My dad was a two-time National Air Race champion in the pylon division. And his team and the San Francisco Flying Club were given credit for inventing retractable gear in aircraft. So both Sean and I have a long history, family history of flying, and have been flying since we were young kids. And I think for me, I still have my Malibu, had it for over 22 years now, and I'm pushing about 6,000 flight hours. The thing I love about flying is being the freedom of being able to go when you want to go, where you want to go, and how you want to go. And that never gets old. My wife's even become a pilot now, so she flies with me. And we have homes in Naples, Florida, and Carmel, California, and we go back and forth in the plane all the time. That's when we do some of our golf schools. And it's really fun to stop off in different places and do fun things. And of course, we had when we were on tour, we did it with the kids, and whether it was CBS or competing, they would come with us, and always seemed to have enough room to get them on board. So it's the freedom of it is pretty amazing, and it's something I'll go to my grave saying I'm glad I got my pilot's license.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking, an hour of your busy schedule to be on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and I think the listeners are going to enjoy it, and thank you very much for your time on this, Bob.
And enjoyed it, Jason. All the best to you. Take care.
All right. I appreciate it.
All right. That was it. Thanks again to Bobby. Our next interview and episode is likely going to be our interview with Adam Beach, who is the owner and creator of the online review service, My Golf Spy. Awesome service. Check it out. They basically do all sorts of equipment testing. There's also some other content on their website, including, course reviews and just articles and thoughts on the golf industry in general. So check that out. We have a couple other interviews in the works as well. Sean McKeel, we will be recording that interview sometime at the end of the month, I believe. And we have another big one that we're working on. And I'm not quite going to confirm it yet, but I think we'll have it all squared away and we'll make a further announcement about that maybe at the beginning of February. So thanks for listening. Hit us up on social media @golf_sub70. Thank you.